One of our favorite oddball TV Christmas moments is Pee-wee's Christmas Special, a star-studded hour-long event that aired in 1988 at the height of Pee-wee Herman's popularity. In the show, Pee-wee learns the true meaning of Christmas as Santa Claus asks him to share his gifts with all the children of the world.
Today we take you inside Pee-wee's Christmas Special with the she-larious Irene Marquette, who is putting on a holiday extravaganza inspired by Pee-wee Herman's holiday show, complete with variety acts and animation in the Curio Show at Chicago's I.O. Theater.
Join us as we talk about what happened to all those crazy wigs and costumes, who was the most difficult celebrity to have on the show, and why Paul Rubens grew to feel trapped by his most popular character ever, Pee-wee Herman.
Plus, Pee-wee Herman returns to TV in an upcoming holiday special on Netflix.
Eve Plum, the actress best known for playing Jan Brady on The Brady Bunch, returns to TV as well in NBC's new production of Grease Live.
And Lady Gaga gets showered with awards. First, a Golden Globe nomination for American Horror Story Hotel. Then, Billboard magazine names her Woman of the Year.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of financial support of people like you. Thank you. Upgrade your account today at feastoffun.com/plus and listen to our fabulous podcast 5 days a week.
Joining us today is the she-larious Irene Marquette, who is putting on her own holiday extravaganza in the Curio Show here at Chicago's I.O. Theater, where she does a presentation about Pee-wee's Christmas Special, studded with variety acts, also inspired by Pee-wee's holiday show.
Yes.
Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I love this premise.
Thanks, me too.
How did you come to be inspired by Pee-wee's Christmas Special and decide to do a whole variety show based on it?
Well, I do a variety show every month on a different theme or subject, and last year around this time, I did a New Year's show. It was all about the new year and what that means in a lot of different ways, and this year, I was thinking about how I wanted to do a holiday special, and what is my favorite holiday special? It's Pee-wee's Christmas Special.
Were you a fan of Pee-wee when you were a kid?
I was a big fan of Pee-wee as a kid. I watched the TV show as it aired.
Yeah.
Yes, and I actually talked like him for about 2 years. There's a video of my... Yeah.
That's not annoying at all.
No, not at all. My parents loved it. There's a video of my grandparents driving away after a visit, and it's me like behind the camera waving and being like, goodbye, goodbye. I think that... My parents were so sick of it. I wore out all the toes of my shoes trying to do the tequila dance everywhere I went.
For people who don't know the tequila dance, it involves you like standing on your tippy toes, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And then you're going like forward and back with your
hands.
Mark, there's a thing with special needs people that where they teach you to do the tequila peewee dance, or it's oral. Fecal, no. Oral, fecal.
I don't know. It's not. I don't know where you got that. But that's not where that's from, Fausto.
No.
We saw Pee-wee Herman speak at South by Southwest. It's when he had his Broadway show, and he was saying that dance came from something his dad would do, but he didn't remember exactly like how it came about or what it was about. And he said it had something to do with your mouth to your butt. And it was like my friend's mother used to do this thing where she would do the same thing. And she was like, because her kids would get sick. And she's like, oral, fecal. And like put her, because like if you wipe your butt and then stick your finger in your mouth, you can get sick. And so I thought maybe that's where that came from.
Yeah, I remember waking up at 10 a.m., like literally setting the alarm to watch Pee-wee's Playhouse, watching and then going back to bed on CBS. And what was it? You know, it was such an extraordinary TV programming for children because it was something that had a very subversive, edgy, countercultural sensibility.
Yeah, I don't know what it was about that show that really like captured me. I think the colors for sure, the different characters, the humor of it is so sophisticated, and the variety element of it, that there's like the genie and all of his furniture talks to him. And there's like such a sense of magic and play about it that I don't know. I just loved it so much.
It was
I
like the Playhouse you wanted as a kid. You know, you grew up on watching like Captain Kangaroo or Mr. Rogers or the Mickey Mouse Club. And it's like, those are all fun. But then you see something like Pee Wee Herman's Playhouse and it's that, but it's twisted.
So twisted.
You know, and a lot of that stuff you hadn't really seen before. That some of those cartoons were weird. These claymation, like little toys and things. Those were also very strange. You're like, it was weird.
Well, to best understand the cultural landscape that brought out Pee-wee's Christmas special and Pee-wee's Playhouse, we have to go all the way back to World War II.
What?
So World War II, there was a lot of military people stationed in the Pacific Islands, and the United States fell in love with the tropics. And so one style of music was called exotica, where artists like Martin Denny would simulate sounds of animals as they played this jazzy lounge music, right? And so fast forward to the mid-80s, all these new people, young generation, started discovering this music and the style, and it became the hot, hot, hot new trend. So we had postmodernism, and our interest in Native American culture and design, especially Hopi culture, and then you had exotica, all coming together in a perfect storm of dazzling and whimsical nature. And that's why Pee-wee's Playhouse has a lot of like tropical birds and you know, things that don't necessarily get associated with a kid's playhouse, you know, and that's because of our fascination with the tropics and Pacific culture in World War II.
That's so cool. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I love the aesthetic that is put on that show. And I think that's a big part of what really attracted me to it as a child. Getting older and rewatching some of that stuff and seeing the original special he did for HBO. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Which is like so much raunchier. And he's like looking up Miss Yvonne's skirt with the mirrors on his shoes. Remember?
Oh, that wouldn't go over today.
No, I don't think so. No. I mean, they didn't include that element of his personality in the Playhouse show, but that same sense of like, it's a child who's a man. It's a man. You know that he's a man, but he's also a child. And like, why is he living alone? And why is he wearing a suit? There's so many like anachronistic things that made perfect sense to me as a kid. I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. This is how I want to live.
Well, Pee-wee's kind of pervy, right? You know, there's a pervy quality to him.
Yeah.
And like but when I first saw him, like, you know, he struck me as a special needs person or something. There's a sort of innocence to him too. Like, we don't know if we're in or out of the joke or the character. And Mark, you said that Pee-wee was a character that was developed with the groundlings to answer a very difficult question.
Well, he was supposed to come up with somebody, a character that wasn't funny or somebody who wouldn't be considered funny. And so this is what he came up with. Because, of course, you have to do somebody that's not supposed to be funny, but then it also has to be funny because otherwise people aren't going
to
laugh.
It was to come up with a character that was annoying, that also it was entertaining at the same time. So you have this push-pull thing happening. And I think that's where Pee-wee sort of just caught like fire. He was on David Letterman, on MTV. He was Back to the Beach with Annette Funicello.
And, oh, yeah, I watched that.
You know, he's just in everything. Bird is the word. You know, he's like, he's just, for a while, like, Pee-wee was everywhere.
That movie was the best thing that ever happened to me. In my childhood, I...
Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's one of Tim Burton's best pieces of work, without a doubt.
It's really made him a big star, too.
Yeah, the all that Danny Elfman music, the colors, all of the characters are just amazing. Every single person that he encounters in that movie just nails it. Nails it. It's so good.
I believe Paul Reubens was begging Tim Burton to do it. Like,
he's a relatively unknown at the time.
Yeah, but Tim Burton was like, I don't know if I want to do this film. And it's both cemented Tim Burton and Paul Reubens as major entertainment personalities to be reckoned with.
Yeah. All I wanted was that pole, you know, that goes from your bedroom to the ground floor where you're fully dressed. Do you remember that? You get out of bed, you slide down a fireman's pole, and then like your breakfast is this very intricate series of machines and levers that presents Mr. T breakfast with like the talking mouth bacon. Oh man, I want it so bad.
Well, and,
aspirational. That's
and,
what I'd say.
And the Christmas special, it begins very differently. We have a what appears to be a choir of marine men.
Yes, singing in beautiful harmony.
But I did a little research about it, and that's not actual Marines. Those are hired choir men from the LA Men's Choir to pretend to be Marines.
So the question is, why? Why dress them like Marines?
Because it was hot. It was sexy. And there's the film, you know, all of Pee-wee's stuff, especially the Pee-wee's Christmas special and Pee-wee's Playhouse, has a lot of Easter eggs with gay sensibilities. And so throughout the whole show, you have like hot naked men, gay icons and
fruitcake,
lesbian icons, gender nonconforming people, and all sort of hiding in plain sight. And as kids who had a very queer sensibility, we're very attracted to that, I think. And it affected us in a very deep way. And that's why we're entertainers today.
Yeah, it affected me for sure. I guess you do really get that sexual energy out of that show. I've always been attracted to sexual energy, I guess.
Well, even like when the sexy Mexican lifeguard and all those people were actually cast in New York City and asked to move to Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
To be part of Pee-wee's Playhouse and Christmas special. So it was like, it was developed in New York, but it was, and that's why it has a very East Coast sensibility. And a lot of like great actors who later began, you know, Lawrence Fishburne playing Cowboy Curtis.
Oh, yeah.
It's extraordinary that he was doing this really ridiculous character.
Yeah, you know? Very over the top. The male lady also.
What is her name? Alpitha.
S-Epatha.
S-Epatha. She's from Law and Order. Mm-hmm. S-Epatha Merkson. And she gives him his first fruitcake in the show.
Yes. What's her name? Rita?
Yeah, she was Male Lady Rita. And, she
and the King of Cartoons, played by William Marshall from the blaxploitation film Blackula and Scream, Blackula, Scream.
It's amazing.
So it's kind of like great to see these. And you know, if you watch Electric Company, there was Morgan Freeman. Was Easy Speller was the name of his character or something?
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know.
Yeah, that. Morgan Freeman and Joan Rivers also were part of Electric Company. She did the voiceover for Letterman. And Joan Rivers and a lot of Oprah at like sort of, you know, at a big important time. Oprah's like imitating Pee-wee. You can actually watch that on Netflix.
Oprah and Whoopi were both coming off The Color Purple, right?
Yeah. I mean,
so they were kind of like they were real big then.
And then there was also a gay sensibility with A Color Purple. And so you have like just every sort of like underground LGBT personality. Katie Lang, before she came out, I was reading about Katie Lang. She was said to be the hardest person to work with for the entire special. And she was the least famous.
That's crazy.
Which is, this is what happens when we do this podcast too. The more famous the person is, the easier it is to work with sometimes. And like the people who are like really anxious about their future and their careers tend to be very difficult and very demanding. And so if you watch Pee-wee's Playhouse Christmas special, you can see how she's just like, I kind of hate this bullshit that I'm in.
Yeah, wow. That performance is pretty, it's aggressive,
it's
I would
aggressive,
say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very dykey, too, isn't it? It's super dykey. It's like, but, I'm going to out here and do this thing.
But there's this sensibility she doesn't like what she's in.
And I would say that she's probably not the most famous, but she had just come off Shadowland, was just released in March, and so this was probably filmed like sometime in the summer or something like that. And so like people knew who she was, and her song was huge. It was a huge hit.
Well, her big Constant Craving hit hadn't hit the charts yet.
Mm. Wasn't that from Shadowlands?
That's what I was reading about it. But it didn't hit the. It didn't. Oh. It was before that. Okay. Her big breakthrough moment. So,
in what ways was she difficult? Did you happen to?
She was late to the taping. She they took a long time. Paul Rubens didn't want to work with her, and she didn't want to work with him. She did lots of takes, and you know. Running these puppets where she's interacting with Cool Chick and what was the name of the dog and
that Beatnik band?
Yeah, the Beatnik band.
Oh, they were so sexy too.
But she was like, she did like 10 takes of that. And it was like, that's what I was reading on behind the scenes. Now, these are all rumors. Obviously, no one's going to verify it because Katie Lang's a big star and they don't want to burn any bridges. But they were saying that she was the hardest person to work with.
Well, you can also see, like, Pee-wee does not interact with her at all. He watches her from a side, so he may not have even seen her performance.
No, that was not taped at the same time.
Yeah.
So, Meanwhile, you have Grace Jones, yes, who comes in for a split second.
Oh, but she's so amazing.
Yeah.
In that crate.
She was supposed to go to the White House and goes to the Playhouse.
That's an accident. That's okay. I loved watching it again after, you know, because I watched it a ton as a kid, and then maybe in the last 7 years or so, it got back on my radar. And that was one of those moments that, like, really made me sit up in my chair. It's so dynamic and striking. The design of her costume, the way that she sings a little drummer boy is so unusual. And it's just, like, beautiful. I think it's...
And her nipple breastplate. You're like, oh, for kids programming. Why not?
Why not? Why not?
Also, you can thank the Sal Soul Orchestra for their disco version of The Little Drummer Boy, which I think influenced a lot of Grace Jones's cover of that song. So if you listen, which is going to be part of our Incredibly Strange Christmas Special, Volume 8, coming at the end of the season this year, where we feature strange and rare Christmas oddities. And certainly Sal Soul's Little Drummer Boys, it influenced Grace Jones in that music. But it has a great 80s sensibility. And then she has this square piece of fabric that she slices in the middle to turn it into a hat.
I thought, you know, she was made out of metal when I was a kid. I was like, who is that robot lady? She's so
cool.
And why
does she travel in a box? And that's the best when she's just like, oh, you're supposed to go to the White House. And he goes, back in the box, Grace. And she's just like, oh, Pee-wee, can I sing a song for you? All right.
Well, that's what it feels like with all the celebrities. They're kind of like shoehorning them into the episode.
Right. And it's kind of funny because, you know, some of the celebrities come to the set and they interact with him. And then other ones are just like on a television screen. And he's like fake talking to them, or they send him messages. And you're just like, he's not even interacting them with it at all. And it's like, it's how many celebrities did they actually shoehorn into that thing? It was like 20 of them.
There's so many. Me, that's something I really appreciate about the special, mm-hmm, is that it kind of, you know, it takes that trope of the Christmas special and just explodes it like everything else on that show. It's so over the top.
You have Grace Jones, Katie Lang, you have Charo doing a Mexican piñata moment, Whoopi Goldberg, Oprah Winfrey, Joan Rivers, Dinah Shore, Magic Johnson, before he came out as HIV positive, Annette Funicello, and Frankie Avalon. They're making Christmas cards for him.
Yeah, they're like a sweatshop.
Yeah,
he makes them make cards all day while he goes outside and plays in the snow. That was very funny.
1,000 cards. And then when he's done doing the cards, they have to make envelopes for him, too.
The work never ends for Annette Funicello.
Now, also there in the special is a Dadel Rubio triplets, which music producer Allie Willis put together. And she was very involved behind the scenes in developing Pee-wee's Playhouse.
That's a dynamic trio of women. How old would you say they are in the special?
And they said they were in their 40s.
Well, it's, you know, when we talked to Allie, and you can check, listen to that podcast too. Allie's fabulous. You should definitely give that one a listen too, because she is right now, her show, The Color Purple, is she did the music for The Color Purple on Broadway. And she also did the theme song to Friends. So she's like loaded.
And no, she done all the hits of The Pointer Sisters, mm-hmm, Earth, Wind, and Fire. Yeah. She wrote the song, Do You Remember? Mm-hmm. Suddenly mm-hmm September.
And the Neutron Dance.
Oh my, so a lot of her music that she wrote not only was very popular as top 40 songs, mm-hmm, but where you really make the money is in the licensing. Every film, every commercial, mm-hmm, and those songs are very popular.
And you might record a song, but you don't necessarily make a lot of money from it if it plays on the radio. But if you're the person that has a writing credit on it, then you get paid. And so Allie, you know, she kind of discovered the Del Rubio triplets and then put them to, you know, she'd throw parties or she'd have events and they would come there. And so people like Pee-wee saw them in her events and like, oh my God, you must come and do our show. And if you look online, it's like, that's one of the few real video things of any quality that you've seen the Del Rubio triplets do. There's some YouTube stuff on there, but it's not quite the same.
And you know, and
Allie said that's the one thing is like, she's like, they really lied about their age. So I'm guessing at the time that they did the Pee-wee Herman special, they were probably early to mid 50s, but at that point in time, they're saying they were like 40 years old or something. And unfortunately, I think when we talked to Allie, one of them had died, and now all three of the triplets are dead.
They're singing in heaven.
They are. There's such a striking part of that in those the little outfits that they've got and their legs, and I just love them.
So I called Stephen Perfidia Kirkham, who has been working on Pee-wee's wigs since they got back on Broadway. And he had some interesting things to say about Miss Yvonne's wigs.
Ooh.
One of them is he says that none of her wigs, the original wigs, are available or are there because they all caught on fire.
What?
There was a fire at the Playhouse.
There was and he didn't explain why they caught on fire in the story. So, but since then, Perfidia has remade all those wigs, including the Christmas tree wig that Miss Yvonne wears. And she said that she was weeping in tears when she wore it again just recently for a Christmas corporate party.
Aww.
But Lin-Marie Stewart, who plays Miss Yvonne, regularly gets hired to be Miss Yvonne for events and parties.
Oh my God, how fun.
I saw that show, the Broadway show, and it was so great to see that same cast of characters that Miss Yvonne was Miss Yvonne. You know, I don't know if you've seen Ace of Base recently, but those two guys replaced the women with like 20-year-old versions of them.
Ew. Ace of Base, the musical group, the Nazi group?
Yeah, the Nazi Swedish super pop band. Yeah, they've refreshed their image, and that usually means like trading in, you know, women who are past 30 for like 18-year-olds, and that's what they did. And
ew.
I know, it's such a bummer. One of the many bummers about Ace of Base is we've learned.
You know, they're Nazis, so that makes sense that they would do that. You know?
Yes.
Well, are they still Nazis? He said that was a long time ago.
Yeah, he's like, water under the bridge. Stop bringing it up.
Stop. But at the same time, you know, if you were a Nazi, go out of your way to sort of make amends for the past.
And this
you know?
Woman would probably be close to 50 now, right? I would imagine the original members of the group.
I mean, I'm thinking that they were probably...
They were popular in 1993, and that's, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah. I would say maybe like early, mid-40s.
Yeah.
Well, and if you listen to Ace of... Not to get sidetracked, but if you listen to their songs, all that she wants is another baby is a wealth... Like,
welfare
disparaging welfare queen. And then the...
Happy Nation.
I Saw the Signs is about the swastika and how this person is has been revived and reborn now that he became a Nazi.
Yeah, and watch the music video for Happy Nation.
Not really.
Yeah, which was the original title of that album in Europe, and they released it in the United States and changed it to The Sign. But that was like what they introduced themselves to the world with. I don't know if you remember that song.
Yeah.
I just remember because I was traveling in Europe when that song became very popular. I was just like, no way will this song make it to number one in the United States. It's so stupid. All that she wants is another baby. What's it even about? Like, we were all confused. Like, why does she want another baby? We thought it was just like another guy to sleep with.
Tonight. I know. I thought she was a prostitute.
Yeah. I thought it was just like, she was like hooking up left and right, and then of course it was, you know.
Well, in the music video, they show that she's Jewish.
Oh, they do?
And she's a Jewish welfare queen who's sucking on the system. Mm. She's praying on a sort of, I guess, a Jewish rosary, and it has a little Star of David on it. So, you know,
some prayer beads.
So it wasn't like they were, you know, he disavowed himself, but a lot of their music now, in hindsight, it's very clear that these were anti-Semitic. Mm. You know, anthems that Americans were happily dancing to in ignorance.
Oh, yeah. All my middle school dances. I was really getting down. I had no idea.
But in contrast, Pee-wee's Christmas special.
Nothing but joy and light. But in any case, I was so happy to see like the real Miss Yvonne there. And I guess she still has the dresses that she wore on the show. And
He says that the original Christmas dress that she wore in this Christmas special is still the same one. It just has been let out a little bit.
I think that's great.
Well, that's what's great about like the whole that little time capsule of that world of Pee-wee's Playhouse is, you know, some 20-some years later, they can still play the same characters, and you know, Miss Yvonne is supposed to be this beautiful woman, and you just roll with it. And not
well, it's meant to be an irony, you know. Yeah. And so as Paul Rubens, who plays Pee-wee's Herman, ages, it becomes even more fun and extraordinary and not less so.
Yeah, you just put on more makeup.
What about Oprah's... we talked about Oprah. She's kind of just like there for a hot second.
Yeah. Hi, Oprah. I'm here. Or hi, Pee-wee. I'm here to promote myself and make sure that I'm in this special so I'm captured here for all eternity.
And you have Oprah doing Pee-wee's laugh, which is fantastic. Little Richard is ice skating.
Yes, what a great scene with one of the best body doubles. that triple axle Pee-wee does or whatever is so fun.
And I guess it's a very homoerotic thing because Pee-wee and Little Richard sort of like keep falling onto the snow into each other's arms.
Yes.
And Little Richard has a pillow on his butt so that Pee-wee won't penetrate him back there.
Well, because he keeps landing on his butt
and he's afraid he's
going to
land on Pee-wee's dick.
Yeah. now the Zsa Zsa Gabor, for people who don't know who the Gabor sisters are, you can Google It's Simple, Darling, one of the most hilarious workout videos on the internet. She has a cameo in Pee-wee's Christmas special.
She should have just come out and slapped Pee-wee and said, "Don't you know who I am?
Did you know?" Now, there's a lot of debate whether Dinah Shore may or may not have been closetedly bisexual, but certainly she is seen as a lesbian icon because of the popularity of the Dinah Shore Weekend. Which I believe even at that time was a popular get together for lesbians. Yeah.
Well, it's like when you think about sports and especially golf, it's like it's very popular with, you know, women of means who are lesbians. They love to play golf. And so yeah. She was this person that loved to play golf. And so the lesbians started coming to this, and it eventually became like a lesbian circuit party. And I guess she was a little dismayed over this. She's like, kind of like, well, it's a little weird because I just did it for the golf, but now all these women are coming to party and play golf.
I mean, when you throw a party, don't you hope that people hook up afterwards? I feel like that is a sign of success. May people hook up in my name somewhere, yeah. Somehow. I think
unless they leave like shit stains on my bed, and okay, then I'm just kind of like, no, yeah. No. Yeah. Take it someplace else.
Yeah, that's a whole different thing.
Part of the reason why we only have three people on the podcast is because when we used to have like more than a single guest, is that sometimes the guests either fight with each other or fuck.
Mm-hmm. On the air.
Later. So we're, you know.
Chase them out.
We have to, yeah, they're like cats. And one time we had two guests on the show, and as when we were done taping, they were fighting the entire show, and it was kind of clear there was a sexual tension. And then later on, they went to my back bedroom, and they started like literally fucking each other.
Oh.
And I was like, I discovered them and I was like, will you guys knock it off? You know, go someplace else. And I was cool with it until it came time
at 2 o'clock in the morning. No. Faust was ready to go to bed.
No.
And there were stains.
No.
And not just lube or
it
sperm.
It was a foot long streak.
Oh.
It was horrifying.
Oh my
God. And Faust was like, I have to go to bed now and my sheets are dirty. And I don't think we had another pair of sheets or something.
No, so I had
like
to wash my sheets.
So we had to wash his sheets at 2 o'clock in the morning, wait for them to dry to put it back on.
I set them on fire.
We have since bought new sheets. If Foster had that picture on his phone, he'd show it to people.
No, I said it to them and he's like, and it ended those two friendships. I was
well,
like,
I don't think they were ever really, they just did that one time.
But they were like, I was just like, listen, you can't come over here and start banging on my bed.
On your bed.
It's crazy.
There
were also like, you know, raging drunks. So there was a lot of substance abuse.
It was
happening
a mess.
There. Yeah.
Literally.
Somebody so maybe that's why Dinah Shore was mad.
Somebody described that podcast as a blowtorch in a tornado or something
oh
like that.
Oh my God.
In Pee-wee's Christmas special, it's revealed that the dinosaur family is Jewish.
That's right.
Who knew? And they're celebrating Hanukkah.
Was that a comment on the Holocaust or something, do you think?
How?
I don't think so. Why would you think
the dinosaurs are extinct?
Oh, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I just thought they were cute.
Aww.
The dinosaur family, and they're also not really dinosaurs because instead of being giant dinosaurs, they're mouse-sized dinosaurs.
Yeah.
They live in a mouse hole.
I feel like they're like the size of dinosaur toys, which I feel like is more of that kid logic that really works for the show. Like, it's a family of dinosaurs that are like things you would play with. I thought it was so sweet.
Well, when you're a kid, you want everything that you play with to be alive, you know? You're like, everything has a personality. It's very appealing to kids.
Yeah, like Tony Baloney.
And I don't want to give it all away, but in the episode, you have some hunky shirtless construction workers.
Oh, that's right, you sure do.
And who are finally take all the fruitcakes that he's been given and turns it into construction materials for a new wing for his playhouse. And to me, that like that moment in the episode seems very anticlimactic, and I felt very unsatisfied because then all of a sudden the whole thing ends, you know. Santa shows up, wraps it all up, and the episode, and you're like, and that always felt,
you're like, what's going on in that fruitcake room? I want to see what else they're building back there.
Well, it just feels like Pee-wee's Playhouse was always like so much fun that when it ended, it was kind of like, oh, it's over.
Isn't that how playtime always was, though? Like, you know, you're a kid and you're playing and then your mom's like, you have to leave in 5 minutes, and you go, and then you're so sad and you forget all of the fun that you just had and like what a great time it was.
Well, I feel like, you know, with good theater and good TV shows, because we have a traditional, the reason why traditional dramatic structure exists is to give us a sense of closure. And with Pee-wee's Playhouse, there really wasn't a conflict to then resolve. So it seems like you're like right now, okay, thanks for listening, bye, you know, in the middle of a sentence, in the middle of a podcast, just it comes to an end.
Yeah, well, I mean, he gets closure by learning the true value of Christmas.
But it seems very inconsequential, right? He's a very greedy character who's like got this long Christmas list. Clonky, his robot, malfunction, almost sets himself on fire because the list is so big.
Yeah.
And Santa reveals to him that like the list is so big that there are no toys left for any boys and girls in the world.
I mean, those are pretty big stakes.
Yeah. So that's, you know, teaching Pee-wee the true meaning of Christmas and teaching the audience that is like, don't be so greedy. Share with somebody else.
And then he gets to go help deliver the presents with Santa.
But if you feel as a viewer that it seems like it's an egomaniacal actor, comedian running amok on a set, believe it, because there was a lot of resentment, both by Paul Reubens and a lot of the cast members who were involved in Pee-wee's Christmas special and Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Where does the resentment come from? What are you talking about?
Yeah. Paul Reubens felt that he was very much trapped and had no social life doing Pee-wee's Playhouse in Los Angeles, and was eager to get back to New York, where all his friends and contacts
and all those movie theaters are.
Well, and a lot of people incorrectly believe that Paul Reubens lost his contract with CBS over getting arrested for exposing himself in a movie theater in Florida. But when in fact CBS was begging him to do two more seasons, because it was it was their most popular Saturday morning program, and it was actually quite. At that time, I believe he was under budget. So he was filming two seasons at the same time, kind of like the way they do Lord of the Rings, you know? And so it was very cost effective and it was a very popular show. So CBS loved Paul Reubens for it. And Paul was just like, look, I'm mentally and emotionally exhausted. I need to leave this. And I think I really do believe that he kind of sabotaged the Pee-wee character because he was eager to kill him off and move forward with his artistic career. And he said, actually, that if someone had just said to him, hey, you know what, you can just take a couple years off and come back and do Pee-wee, he wouldn't have tried to sabotage it, consciously or unconsciously, like that.
How old was he at that time?
I don't know.
Well, he graduated from high school in 1970, so he would have been 18 at that year. I just saw his mugshot from
high school. He's in 1952, so if you do the calculations... 1988 minus 1952. He was 36 years old at the time.
Wow.
He's 2 years
older than both of you.
Younger. than the both of us.
Yep.
So if you look at it, you know, especially I actually started watching, I guess Pee-wee's Playhouse is also on Netflix. And I started watching the first episode, which a very young Natasha Lyonne plays one of the kids.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, I think and Paul Reubens is in a much better mental space today. You know, certainly like he's working on a new special.
It's supposed to come out in March of this year.
Is it another Pee-wee special?
We looked at Netflix and they're like coming March 2016, a Pee-wee holiday special. So I don't know why it would come in March. Maybe it's the St. Patrick's Day. You know, we saw him speak at South by Southwest, and he said and he's very candid about, you know, his getting busted in the movie theater, and just he's like, whatever, it's, you know, it's part of life. And afterwards he goes, I wanted, when I did that first film afterwards, I wanted to look exactly like my mugshot. So when he did like Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah.
He looked like his mugshot, and then that you see that scene where he dies at the end, and it's almost as though it's like he's imitating himself masturbating. But when he went on hiatus afterwards, and he went and stayed at Doris Duke, who you know was a an heiress, who was like a billionaire or something like that, and he stayed at her cottage and on her estate, and the same cottage that Imelda Marcos stayed in
after she
fled the Philippines that first time. Yeah, so.
So you're saying that, like, Pee-wee was in political exile.
He was in exile, yes.
So yeah. The Curio Show is going to be on December 29th.
That's right.
And that features your interpretation of Pee-wee's Christmas special.
Yeah, and I think that it will probably have the same dissatisfying ending that this one has. Aww. I'm really looking for, I'm looking to present kind of that feeling that the show has, which is just like nonstop guests and performances and excitement and constantly changing. I really want the audience to never know what is going to happen. So I'm scheduling a lot of people to interrupt me. And
are you have puppets?
Yeah, a friend of mine, Cammie Upton, who is a creature creator, and she worked on Box Trolls, Paranorman. She's creating an animation, kind of like, you know, that the Penny cartoon or the King of Cartoons. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
for a little moment like that. And I've got a magician. I've got some burlesque dancers. I've got some singers. Becca Brown from School of Rock, the girl who was the bassist, she's going to be rocking out.
And I'm trying to get some of our drag queens on the show, so hopefully they'll be able to do it as well.
Are you playing Pee-wee?
I'm gonna be Irene.
Aww. Are you gonna wear a suit?
You know, I might go with like a little gray dress.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll see. I'll do kind of my version
of
that. Yeah, maybe.
So a lot of the times, it's if Irene. It's very much 90% Irene Marquette and 10% the inspiration of the thing. It's not like 50-50.
Well, I mean, it really depends on the... You're talking about for the Curio Show in general?
Yeah.
It depends on the subject matter. Sometimes I'll pick something a little bit esoteric, like the idea of Aphrodite, and then I'll really explore that idea, and all of the performers will take it on. Maybe they'll be do a piece about Marilyn Monroe, or there'll be... you know, something about the Greek gods or whatever. And then I'll kind of tell my own story throughout. So for this, I will be acting as the host and I'll be talking about Pee-wee's Christmas special. But I'll also be kind of in that Pee-wee role where this is my world and all of these other people are kind of coming into it and adding to it. And
are you going to address growing to feel trapped and hating your own most popular creation?
I think that's a great thing to address. And now that you've brought it up, yes, I will. I'm taking a note.
She's writing it down right now.
Wait a second. This podcast is research for your show, not the other way around. So you recently just got back from Montana.
Yeah.
Doing a short film with filmmaker Jeff Verlanek.
That's right. That's his name. It's called Butte Bangs.
Butte Bangs.
Butte Bangs.
Where it's a mother who starts to realize that her 9-year-old son is a little bit different than other boys.
Yeah, I'm playing the single mom, and very kind of working class, really concerned with just getting by. I don't think I'm the nicest mom, and I think more than me realizing that there's something going on with him, the movie's more from his point of view, and he's realizing that he's different and that he has feelings that probably are not accepted in this rural world that we're in.
So you basically play a trashy wild woman who has a kid.
Yeah, I'm a trashy wild woman. I've got a kid. I'm real bad. I smoked like half a pack of cigarettes in a bathroom. It was so fun. I have to.
Do you smoke?
No, I used to smoke, but I quit like 5 years ago.
So now you act smoke?
Yeah, I will smoke for
a role.
Yeah, I'll smoke for a role.
And you happen to get cast in roles every day?
Yeah, that just make me smoke.
What I quit smoking, but every character I play is a smoker.
Just has to
smoke. I only
smoke
when I act.
That's it.
I'm acting all the time.
Do you feel like
it's
Mark,
like my sisters. I only smoke when I drink. I'm like, you drink every day.
Yeah.
So you smoke every day.
Well, I mean, do you feel like as a reformed smoker, Mark, that if you got cast in a role where you had to smoke a cigarette,
would I do it?
Would you feel comfortable doing that?
I probably would do it, especially if it was a paid gig, for sure. If it wasn't paid, I wouldn't do it. Or maybe if it was like high profile enough, or if I was interested in it. But it would take a lot for me to want to do that, just because it's like I'd be afraid that I would have nightmares again.
How much did you smoke?
I smoked like well over a pack a day for like years. I started smoking when I was a small child,
3 years old.
Yeah, my parents would like walk away from the ashtray and I'd go over and take a sip of the beer and then a puff of the cigarette. And so I basically have been smoking almost my entire life. And then like my whole house was filled with cigarette smoke growing up. So my lungs are probably like, they're shot.
It's like, and this is why I have such a wonderful radio voice.
But no, I would be hard pressed to smoke again.
Now in butt bangs,
butte bangs.
I'm reading off a sheet of paper.
Also known as like the Utah claw or mall bangs, right?
Oh my God, I love it. Yes.
It's a reference to your big hair bangs.
Yeah, I had to get a haircut. They gave me bangs, so I've got like this. I've got this little bang here that you can kind of see. It's so sad.
It's very Superman without the S.
Thank you. Yeah. Some of it is clipped back, but they curled this girl, Lisa, she was so awesome, painstakingly curled my hair because they wanted, first of all, Jeff wanted to give me a perm. And thankfully, they were like, we cannot give this woman a perm. Don't do that to
her. Why? What's wrong with a perm?
A perm? Come on.
It'll mess up your hair?
Yeah, it'll damage my hair.
People,
I mean, it's
do
permanent
perms all the time.
I know, but I don't know if a perm really fits into the rest of my lifestyle.
You just be like, I have kinky hair for a while.
Yeah, that's just how, I mean, I will say that every wig I've ever bought looks the way my hair looked in this movie. She painstakingly curled my hair, and I've got, it doesn't look like it, but I've got a lot of fine hair. Mm-hmm. And it was massive. It was like, did you see Angela Bassett on American Horror Story last night? Okay. The way that her hair was in the episode last night was how my hair looked all weekend long, and I couldn't wash it for like 5 days.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So then everybody who was working on this movie only knew me as this woman with like insane hair and some really tight diner outfit. And the last day I finally took a shower, and the boy who played my son said, "You look so weird." And I was like, "Thank you."
Now I look weird.
Now I look weird.
Well, you got used to seeing you like that.
What was it like working with like an 8-year-old kid?
It was awesome. He was great. He was the nephew of Jeff, who is the filmmaker, and he is not an actor. I didn't have acting experience, but I mean, he was just like so excited for it and really ready. And the first day, he was like so focused and a little bit nervous. And by the second day, he was there being like, who's in focus? Where's my frame? What's this shot?
Now, part of the challenge here for it's an 8-year-old boy, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's asked to basically sort of hint at the fact that he might grow up to identify as gay.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, how did that young child navigate that, or how did he handle that? Because it's like, if someone, as an 8-year-old boy, someone said, "Hey, you need to pretend to be a realistic 8-year-old gay boy," that's not an easy thing to pull off.
Well, I think that Jeff handled that really well and kind of parsed those moments out to him in a really nice way. And because it's a short film and all of the moments are so important, those things were a little bit more symbolic, and I think gave him something beyond sexuality to relate to. Like, you're frustrated because your mom is not paying attention to you, or you feel different about this. You feel different about whatever, you know, this inside of yourself, you feel different. I think that, I don't know. I'd be really interested actually to have a conversation with him, like, 10 years from now. And I'm so curious what this whole experience is like in retrospect to
him. He won't remember any of it.
That's right. I know. Well, it's like, I'll just remember that he got to be in a movie.
Well, all those child actors, like the little boy who was in Mavi and Rose, who play their, you know, gender or sexual nonconforming characters, it's really an extraordinary performance by anybody. And sort of like in Krampus, the new movie, there's two young girls who play sort of very butch, tomboy characters, which I might, you know, you can assume that it's like not really their true.
Well, the dad wanted them to be boys. So these girls they probably picked girls that were kind of tomboyish for the
role. To begin with.
And they're like, just pretend like you're dudes. You know? You're like, okay.
It was really funny. There was a scene where it's a fantasy sequence where I actually look good and my bangs are controlled and I've got like good makeup on and I am smoking in the bathroom, and it's him kind of seeing me as like this 1940s mm-hmm. movie star, and we shot it all on film also, and I think it's gonna look so cool. But from his point of view, for him to really look at me like that, it was fun seeing Jeff coach him through that and to be like, when you watch movies, like, who are the ladies that you think are like so beautiful? And he was like, I don't know, I just watch SportsCenter. Like, I
you see a touch, like you see a touchdown. Like, what goes through your mind? You actually had to record a sex scene.
Yeah, I did. It was an audio
sex. What was that like, doing a sex scene with an 8-year-old?
Okay, well, first of all, he was gone.
That was with another adult.
Okay.
Yeah. He had gone away, and I guess it will just be like the sound. Like, he's going to hear the noise through the door. So we had to record that, mm-hmm. like, the sex noise. So the director had left, and I think he was dropping off his nephew. And me and the girl who was the sound engineer, she and I were recording this in, like, my bedroom. So we're both sitting on the bed, and she was like, I think it just should be a little bit breathy. Like, I don't think it's that obvious. So I'm sitting there, and I'm like, like that kind of thing. And she's like, that sounds great. That sounds fine. So Jeff comes back and he sits in the living room and he's got his headset on and he's listening to me moaning with his eyes closed. And he's like, no, this isn't right. It's not right at all. So we go back in the bedroom.
It was too porny.
It was too soft. It was too subtle.
Oh, you wanted like, like that?
Maybe somewhere in between those two places. So he's laying on the floor and I'm laying on the bed, and the girl, her name was Haley. She was so amazing. Everyone on the set was so cool. She was sitting in the closet, so I really had to like use my diaphragm and really project my orgasm.
Why was she sitting in the closet?
Because I think
you want to record the audio muffled.
Yeah. Well.
Because she's from out. She wants to be from outside the room.
Well, yeah. I mean, the door was open. Okay. I think it was just so that I would be loud enough for her to.
Okay.
You know, for technical reasons to be able to be captured the sound so they can manipulate it and have it not be noisy.
Yes. So I'm laying on the bed and Jeff is laying on the floor and he's like, I just wanted to be like, and I'm like, okay. So then I start to do that. And then I'm like looking over at him and he's like, more like bigger like this. And then he would do it. And then I would do it.
Why don't you just like start masturbating and just start.
I mean, it would be so much easier to have.
Donna Summer did that in Love to Love You Baby. She was rumored to. Love to Love You Baby. The
producer was fingering her.
Yeah,
that is so great. I did not know that. That would have made my job so much easier.
You should have brought your husband along with you.
I know, he would have helped me.
So what was the final product then?
So the final product, I mean, I haven't heard it yet, but he was satisfied with the way it turned out.
Oh,
he loved it. Love to Love It.
Can I get that as a ringtone?
Yes, you can. And the best part.
So every time you call, it's like.
Fausto.
I'll do that for you, Fausto.
Do it right now, just to let the people edit it.
No, I'm wrapped. You wrapped me.
Okay.
But the best was leaving that bedroom and having all of the guys wrapping up equipment and like trying to be very mature about it and not like they were hearing me so vocally through the door.
You lit up a cigarette. You're like,
who's next?
So literally it was like, okay, give me sex sounds. And you're like, no, that's a 2.
Yeah.
So give me a 5. No, now I need a 10. And then, no, knock it down to a 9. And you're like, you're a jukebox of orgasmic sounds.
That's right. It was just, Montana was a great experience.
So what would be like a 1?
I think it would probably be that like, like, which I think was what I was doing before. Just like breathy. I don't know.
So who's banging you in this thing?
Oh, this like mountain man. He's like sitting in the car. I go to pick my son up from my sister's house. And I've got like my makeup smeared and I added like a hickey on my neck. And then you see us in the car. We're just like driving in the car together. And you only see like the side of his face. Ugh, it's very shady. I feel like I'm a sad character.
Oh,
well, you're like me, and this is maybe why we click together so much, is we're both attracted to very exaggerated and you know, trashy is a very unkind word. I said people on the fringes of society.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
On the edge.
Exactly. People who are, I don't know, living, they're living, you know?
Living on the edge, though. There's a certain, like, everything can come apart. Like, everything can fall apart at any moment.
Yeah. I am absolutely attracted to that. And it's really, I don't know, satisfying to get to play a part like that. Somebody who is so desperate, and being in Montana for a week and a half and driving through these really like decrepit towns, like these old mining towns that are not really viable anymore, seeing how desolate that landscape is. It's so beautiful. But when we were there, you know, there were days it was negative 11 degrees and it was snowing.
And this is November when you were there, right?
Yeah, like over Thanksgiving.
So you guys did not get the El Nino winter that we got here.
No. We got a for real cold, mountain, snowy, brutal winter for that week. And to just think about like what kind of woman would be, you know, working at a diner trying to...
I'm watching Fargo.
Yes.
I'm seeing it.
Yeah, I'm loving this warm weather, warm winter that we're having here in Chicago. And I'm like, hurry up and finish the Feast of Fun season so we can get partying. next week, we're going to be talking to Carl, the pirate Santa from Santa's in the Barn.
Ooh.
So imagine RuPaul's Drag Race, erase the drag queens and replace them all with Santa Clauses.
Wow.
And that's what the TV show's premise is.
That sounds great.
10 Santa Claus compete to be America's best Santa and make the best Santa
win.
Now, you've been watching American Horror Story.
Yes.
And Lady Gaga has been nominated for a Golden Globe Award.
Yay!
Congratulations for playing Madonna.
What do you mean she's playing Madonna?
She's playing a bloodthirsty vampire who can't act.
Ooh.
Oh, I'm just kidding.
Ooh.
I'm just kidding.
Snap. Well, the Golden Globes, they're still political. A lot of times they give these awards to people who they think are just going to draw viewers to the awards.
Well,
more than anything.
It'll work.
And it'll work. And people will watch because of her. And not to say, I am enjoying her performance in it. You know, is it the best in this TV series? I don't know. But it's just, even when she's like bad at it, it's still fun to watch.
I think she's been pretty solid the whole way through. And I mean, she's got some big shoes to fill. Like, she's basically replacing Jessica Lange as the female lead on that show. And I think she's matching the camp level for sure. I feel like she is just eating the scenery and like just... I mean,
eating the character.
It's a great role for her because you can't do that over the top kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
and I love how fearless she is with like showing her body. And I mean, she's fucking somebody like every episode, I feel like.
Oh, I wish I had that job.
Okay, give me five. Give me a 10. And at the same time, Billboard magazine has named Lady Gaga Woman of the Year.
That seems a bit of a stretch.
Well,
Billboard magazine.
Okay,
it's Billboard.
That's right.
You know, and part of it is Lady Gaga says that younger people in the music industry have turned their backs on her, but not the seasoned veterans like Tony Bennett and Elton John, who have given her the strength she needs to persevere as a female entertainer. Mm-hmm. She's no longer a musician. She's an entertainer.
Well, she is an entertainer. She's an actor. She's a singer.
And she's a fashion icon. Mm-hmm. You know,
basically all of that.
Throw crazy shit on Lady Gaga. You know, the thing that bothers me about Lady Gaga, the one thing is that it's the whole debate with the meat dress. Who came up with the dress? Who owns the rights to it? And who like gets credit? Because we actually interviewed the guy who made that on the show. And now they're like going around and backpedaling. And it was like somebody else's idea.
No, there was just an article that somebody said.
Is that what it was?
Yes, somebody misquoted somebody somewhere, and this guy was getting the credit for the meat dress. That's what happened there.
And I hate it when that happens. You know,
because it's like, no, you didn't create that meat dress for hers. He may have done some other looks for Lady Gaga, but not that one.
And that meat dress is credited with raising awareness for marriage equality and bringing about like the lifting of the military's ban on on lesbians and gay men. And I mean, it's a fashion icon. Time magazine says it's the decade's most, one of the top 10 most important fashion statements.
Wow.
Frank Fernandez.
Yeah.
We interviewed him, and you can check that podcast out. If you just look Feast of Fun, Lady Gaga's meat dress. We talked to him about that.
How did they preserve it?
They didn't preserve it. It was taxidermied later on. Basically, they turned it into beef jerky, and then they painted it red for the, I think it's in the Smithsonian right now. But when they actually made it, it was just fresh meat from his family's, butcher shop. Yeah, his family's like Argentinian butchers, so
wow.
They had really, really nice meat on Lady Gaga's body.
I think there's
body.
some flank steaks in there,
and I would have been like, hey baby, we need a couple of filet mignons too, just to make sure they taste good.
Was it lined? Or was that just meat on flesh?
It was just meat on meat.
It was meat on flesh, and there was a twine used to stitch it together. But he built it in panels, and it was kept refrigerated. And then I believe there were actually two of them, and one was worn for the MTV's runway. And then the other one was worn on Ellen.
And there was, she almost didn't wear it. There was other choices, and she's like, let's go with the meat dress. We'll do that. So you guys, you remember Jan from the Brady Bunch, Eve Plum?
Yes.
So she's back. She's going to be in the live, Fox's live version of Grease. She is going to play the shop teacher.
Whoa. Yeah.
There's a shop teacher in Grease?
Yeah, it was played by Alice Ghostly. You remember her? She was the maid in, not the maid, she was...
she was the farm, the construction, the car repair person on Green Acres.
No, she was in Bewitched. She was...
She was also in Green Acres, too.
Oh, was she?
Yeah, she had a kind of voice
Aunt Esmeralda. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she played the shop teacher in that movie.
She was one of those actors of that time period that was on every TV show.
And I'm guessing probably a lesbian.
Pretty much everybody on Bewitched, with the exception of Elizabeth Montgomery, was queer. The writers, the actors, and actually if you watch the pilot episode of Bewitched, it's a allegory for someone who is in a same-sex relationship and their parents don't approve of them.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I had no idea.
Yeah, if you watch it, it's very clear.
Curio that, show.
Yes, I'm writing this down. Excuse me while I take
the
notes.
The pilot episode of Bewitched is that Elizabeth Montgomery's character, Samantha, finds herself in somewhat of a same-sex relationship, a relationship that her parents do not approve of because it's, you know...
He's a mortal.
Mortal. Mm-hmm. And so the mortal becomes like... a euphemism for being queer, for being gay, and that she's in a mortal relationship.
You know, what's very interesting is, like, you know, all the actors on the back in the day, like Gilligan's Island and these other shows from the 60s, is none of the actors ever got, royalties after, like, when in distribution, except for Elizabeth Montgomery, because she was actually a producer of the show.
Whoa.
But they didn't name her on the credits as a producer because they thought it would be unseemly to have a woman producer as a credit. So she's not credited in the producer of it on the TV show, but she did. She got those checks all those years later.
Man, I wish my eye roll made a sound. That's amazing. That's a great story.
In the original Darren, they got rid of him because he was an alcoholic.
Dick York.
And he manhandled her one day, and she was just like, get him out.
Wow. Yeah. Had no idea.
Yep. Curio show.
Yeah, and gosh, replaced him with Dick Sargent.
Yeah.
Who was later came out as gay, and for a while Dick Sargent and Elizabeth Montgomery were grand marshals for gay pride parades all over the country.
Did Dick Sargent get HIV?
Yeah, he died of AIDS.
Blah, blah. All these TV dads that died of AIDS.
Yeah, Mike Brady also. Yeah. That's another Curio show for you.
TV dads who died of AIDS?
Yeah, there's only two that I know of, but
alcoholism. You know,
there might be more.
This is, you know, the life of a Hollywood actor is not always sunny and fun. Mm-hmm. You know,
my favorite thing with Mike Brady though is you see him at the Sid and Marty Krofft's TV show that they did. They had a variety show and the Brady Bunch kids performed in it, and they pan to the audience and it's Mike Brady sitting with a very dykey Alice, and Florence Henderson says she doesn't know whether Alice was transgender or if she was a lesbian. She goes, I really don't know what her deal is, but she was definitely one of the funniest people I knew. And then there was another gender nonconforming person sitting with them. I don't know if they were if it was a drag queen or if it was somebody who was in the early stages of transitioning or somebody who just didn't, you know,
give a fuck.
But they're all sitting there and they're drinking. It's at the Hollywood Bowl, so it's outside the sunset. And they're all sitting at a table and they're drinking what looks like scotch.
And the only way you can see this is you have to get the VHS version of the Brady Bunch kids live at the Hollywood Bowl and then pause it. Mm-hmm. And as they cut to the audience, that's the only way you can see it.
Because we were watching it and I was like, wait a second.
So we're pause, frame. Andy Davis, Mike, what was the anime actor who played Mike Brady?
Mike Reed?
Robert Reed.
Yeah.
And some gender nonconforming person with cocktails in their hands. Mm-hmm. You remember who is Martin Tricchelli, the douchebag CEO?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So yes. This week, Wu-Tang Clan revealed that their $1 million album, I guess it's a $2 million album, was sold to the douchebag CEO, Martin Tricchelli, who said that he would be happy to play it as long as Taylor Swift comes over to his house.
Ew. He's the worst of the worst, right?
Yeah, so for people who are not familiar with Martin Tricchelli, he recently purchased the rights to a drug used to treat a deadly parasitic infection and raised the price of the drug 5,000% from $13 a pill to $750. And there was a lot of internet backlash because it brought attention to the unfair price hikes that pharmaceutical companies do regularly. And the fact that we still don't really have real healthcare reform in this country. We're just basically forced to buy healthcare. A vast majority of Americans still don't have healthcare. And so they're now being penalized by the IRS for not having it. And the ones who do have it don't take advantage of it because they can't afford the very high premiums. I'm sorry,
Deductibles.
When you go to the doctor and all that stuff, that you can't afford to pay for it because every month you're paying for high prices for your healthcare that you're being forced to buy. So Wu-Tang Clan revealed that they sold it for $2 million.
And that was an anonymous auction, right?
It was an anonymous auction. And then they realized. And then Martin Tricchelli was interviewed and he said at the right price, these rap artists will basically do anything. He plans to hire them to perform for him at a future party. And it says he's very taken by Wu-Tang's song's Cream, which stands for Cash Rules Everything Around Me, and includes the often repeated phrase that he has embroidered, Dollar Dollar Bill, y'all. Now, today, Wu-Tang Clan, there's rumors going around that Bill Murray is involved in this scandal.
Bill Murray?
The comedic genius.
He did appear with the RZA in Coffee and Cigarettes, if I recall. Mm.
So Wu-Tang $2 million album has been rumored now to have a clause where they or Bill Murray can steal it back from Martin Tricchelli. And this might be just a... publicity.
What do you mean they can steal it back?
Well, so this is what's going on with contract law in the United States, according to the internet, is that you can't just excuse a crime by saying you wrote it in a contract. But if you define a crime as an agreement between two parties, it no longer becomes theft. So if I make you sign a contract that says that at any time I can just show up to your house and steal it from you, then technically I'm not stealing it from you. And therefore, Wu-Tang Clan or Bill Murray, it's rumored that they might be able to have a music heist, break into somehow Martin Shkreli's compound and steal back their $2 million.
Well, I'm sure they
have
copies of the file somewhere, don't they?
It was destroyed. The originals, everything was destroyed. The only existing copy of that album Martin Tricchelli has his hands on. So
yeah, I think that was the big requirement thing with this, because it's been how long since they
put something else out?
I think it's been a lot longer.
Since they put something out. Yeah. I want to say a decade or something.
At least, yeah.
Yeah.
Late 90s.
So what if he doesn't want to give it back? What if he's like, I'm sorry.
They can steal it back. That's about part of the contract. So it's not really technically they're breaking the law. They're just...
But they have to find it, get it, and take it back. But he could be hiding it anywhere.
He could.
It could be in the Himalayas. It could be on Mount Everest.
He's a monster.
He's
well, you know, the real monster is the fact that the pharmaceutical industry and healthcare lobbyists have really destroyed any chance of our generation getting access to healthcare. And
I thought you were going to say getting access to a new Wu-Tang album.
Or you know, and to me, it's like as we grow older, it's like it you know, and you're a freelancer too.
Yeah.
I don't know I don't want to ask you what your healthcare situation is, but
please don't.
I'm sure it's tenuous.
Tenuous at best.
And so we're all kind of walking a weird tightrope, our generation. And as we age, it's very disturbing that our ability to be taken care of by our own society is up for grabs, even though we pay our taxes.
It's insane. Yeah, I completely agree with you. You know. Did I ever tell you about my experience with Ghostface Killa?
No.
Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
Okay. I was an undead druid on stage with Ghostface when he was in Chicago at the Abbey Pub. So me and like five other women were in long red velvet robes holding candles surrounding him after he died. And then his words brought him back to life. And we
his
got
own
to leave
words
the,
brought his, him back.
Yes, of course. Okay. Yes. In a big magical book that he presented. And I will say that his road manager had a after the show was over, he was in the downstairs area making like this kale quinoa blueberry salad for Ghostface for him to eat because he was really concerned about his nutrition.
Those musicians, you got to take care of them.
You got to take care of them.
Kale, blueberry, and quinoa salad?
I believe, yes. It was
that
like
sounds delicious.
Yeah, I was really surprised. He also travels with a chocolatier who makes like... He travels with a chocolatier.
That's somebody he's dating.
Yeah. And there was a photographer, a fake photographer, who had snuck in to the VIP lounge and drank like all of the Hennessy that was down there. And we had been up on stage and we came back down. And this guy, I think he was probably like 19. I don't know how he got in there. And he was taking pictures of everybody. He was finger blasting his girlfriend on a chair. And Ghostface walked in and saw it. And he was like, "Get this motherfucker out of here." It made me laugh so hard. I was like, this is the best thing I've ever seen in real life. I cannot believe it. And I did smoke a blunt on stage.
Wow.
Your life sounds like a music video.
Thank you.
It almost doesn't seem like it's just a part of your script or something.
No, it's real. I have pictures of it.
So where were
it.
You when this Show guy the was finger blasting this chick?
Well, we had been like rehearsing and then we were up on stage and like I think that he thought everybody else was occupied and we all walked in the room. And I mean, it was very apparent what was going on. She had some loose shorts on and he was helping himself.
Mm. To explain people all those terms that she just said, Hennessy is a French cognac. Popular with rappers and African Americans. And Ghostface Killa is the stage name of Dennis Coles, who's a prominent member of the group Wu-Tang Clan.
Yes, that's right. And a very popular solo artist.
Is there anything else we need to explain? There's so much happening there. And fingering is a...
when you take your fingers...
and stick them up your body parts to make yourself feel special.
Ooh, love to love you, baby.
Ooh. Oh. Is it fun to moan into a microphone?
You know, yes.
Yeah, it's more fun to moan into a microphone than to anything else.
Or moaning in general. Because, like, you know, in real life, I'm like, Mark, I'm...
Fausto moans.
But I'm quiet, though.
But he's quiet in the bedroom. It's the only time Fausto shuts up. It's true.
But like true. In real life, you
except
know,
he does come with his own porn soundtrack sometimes. He'll walk in the room like, boom. I'm like, all right.
Is it like real music or is that like
no, he's
mouth noises?
He's singing. Okay, cool. He's singing it. They're doing noises. Like
well, I mean,
that.
Life is a musical and the soundtrack never stops.
He also wakes up singing.
But yeah, and so, but I think moaning into a microphone is very nice, especially if you have your earbuds and you can hear, monitor your own voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because then you're like, I want to thank people for listening to today's show. Ooh, Irene Marquette. Oh,
you
are a perfect fit.
Oh,
you really stimulated our minds with your encyclopedic knowledge. Oh, it's so big.
Thank you.
If you need any help,
I know doing moans,
call me up. I love doing moaning sounds into a microphone.
Yeah, I'll give Jeff your number.
Yeah, I'll be like, ooh, wouldn't it be crazy if like this happened with RuPaul's movie Star Booty? I guess they couldn't find the person who was playing RuPaul's daughter in the movie, so they just got like a friend of theirs to do the voice, and it's like, Auntie Star Booty, what's going on? What are you guys doing to me? And it's hilarious, but has nothing to do with the woman who plays her is a very beautiful transgender actress. But the guy's doing the voice is like just this
thick. My body. It was weird because we're like, it seems like a real dissonance between the characters. And you're like, what's going on there? And it was Lady Bunny that told us, right? That that they're like the person shot it. And then, of course, you have to go in and re-record everything because you did it on a budget. So your sound's not very good to begin with. So you have to go back and re-record it. And she was nowhere to be found.
Well, films and television programs used to all be overdubbed, right?
Yeah,
even Star Trek was that way.
Those spaghetti westerns, they do that. I know. Who did 8 and a Half?
Kim Basinger,
Fellini. Yeah.
I think he liked to play music on his sets. So, like sometimes you see the actors kind of like bop it around a little bit, but that means that they had to re-record all the dialogue on top. So it's a little like dissonant in that way.
But I don't believe television or you've done a lot of industry stuff. It's like it's no longer done after the fact.
Well, they call it ADR when you have to do it.
Yeah,
because there's like an accident.
This happened to us in Cooking with Drag Queens. One of the guests that we had on, she mispronounced a word. It was so funny the moment that I overdubbed her voice.
You'll never know because it just dropped a consonant there. But that consonant makes the world of difference.
But it was kind of like I had to imitate their voice and then I cut out the consonants and pasted it over their own voice. So it's indistinguishable from it. But, you know, Mark was like, what are you doing? Because it sounded really crazy.
But it works. You would never know.
No.
Ever know.
And we'll reveal who
that. We'll reveal who that was maybe at a later date.
The same night as RuPaul reveals the next season of RuPaul of the girls. That's happening on the RuPaul's blue screen Christmas.
Green screen.
Ooh, yeah. Can't wait for that.
Not the blue screen. It's the green screen.
Oh, yeah. Remember the old blue screen?
Yeah.
When did that? I feel like
I thought it's always been green screen. Hasn't
I think it was blue for.
It used to be blue, and then they switched it to green.
But it's been green for a long time.
A long time.
Yeah. But when I did a cable access, we had a blue screen.
I also did cable access. I think we talked about this.
Honey, you and I are sisters.
We are sisters. We're sister soulmates.
You guys could be related.
Yeah. I was like, if I dress up in drag, I always think about you. It's like,
Thank you.
Your characters.
I'll be a pretty lady, just like Irene.
A very extreme woman on the verge of a nervous breakdown.
Yes.
The Curio Show, December 29th. You guys, if you live in Chicago, please come see this. We're going to go to it. It's fantastic. Sit in the front row.
Yes.
It's one of those comedy shows that, like, it's not annoying and it's fun. And
yeah, like, I think so. I mean, I really try my best to not make it annoying.
Well, it's, you know, there are, like, sometimes it's a lot of fun. And the fact that, like, the whole thing falls apart or, you know, that's what's fun about improv is that you never know what's going to happen.
Well, this is a little bit more structured.
And it's a lot of structure.
Yeah. I put a lot of work into making it a real show, a real experience.
I can't wait. I'm going to be there with bells on.
Good.
And before we go out, I want to do a shout out to all the people that are protesting Mayor Rahm Emanuel and taking over the streets and shutting down Michigan Avenue and getting into Macy's and really causing a havoc. Because it's, you know, people are saying, well, they should just be protesting at City Hall. Well, City Hall doesn't really get that much coverage. But when you block the highways, when you block Michigan Avenue, when you interrupt the commerce, you bring attention to your demands and what you want, and you want to see real change. And this is how real change happens. You have to get into people's faces and you have to stand up and say, hey, we're not going to take this shit anymore.
Well, also, Chicago doesn't have a real, does not have a way to recall its mayor. There's no way, like, he could murder people, and it's like he could be the mayor from prison.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure exactly legally what happened, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure what would happen. No, I'm sure that he would have to, I don't know.
We don't know. It's unprecedented. And in this case, it's like he's been involved in a systemic cover-up of police murders
and I'm seeing
of its own citizens.
And I'm seeing on Facebook, especially from white people, saying that this is not the way to go bring about change. And it's just like, well, if you can think of a better way to do it, why don't you get out and do it for these people? But you can't, so shut the fuck up.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, yes.
I want to remind folks, too, that we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, consider signing up today at feasttofun.com/plus, because your contribution to the show is what makes this show happen. And we have fantastic t-shirts for sale at our store, feasttofun.com/store. And we are offering express shipping. Just fill out the regular shipping, and it will come to you express up until the 15th of December. Yeah. So order your stuff now.
So you get it in time for the holidays. Yes. You just have a couple days left. 15th of December, honey. Express shipping. Get your Feast of Fun Tea t-shirt. Spend some money. Irene Marquette.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. I love this.
We love you.
Anytime, baby. Come back.
I will. I would love to.
Bye.
Bye.